I'm Will Lemansky from MLNL Insurance, and you're listening to the Michigan Constitution Podcast.
Welcome to the Michigan Constitution Podcast, where the citizens of the Mitten State seek the pleasant peninsula between their state and federal identities through a deeper understanding of how Michigan's Constitution and its defining case law affects their everyday lives. Your host, Tony Snyder, is a licensed Michigan attorney with more than a decade of experience in private and government practice. Through this podcast, you'll better understand the unique characteristics of Michigan's supreme law and probably learn a few fun facts about federalism, too. And now, here's Tony.
Welcome back to episode number 45. This time, we're going to continue our conversation about bail under the Michigan Constitution. But first, your spoonful of legalese.
The purpose of this podcast is merely to teach you what's in the Michigan Constitution. Each podcast will review a different article section, we'll talk about what it means, and we'll review Michigan case law, which helps us to better understand the effects of those constitutional provisions. Here's what this podcast is not. It is not legal advice. It is not legal expertise. Although I am a licensed attorney in the state of Michigan, I make no warranties as to the veracity of the statements I make within this podcast. First of all, I don't practice constitutional law. I practice administrative law. Second, the laws change on a day-to-day basis, as does case law. What might be applicable the day I make a statement about the Michigan Constitution could very well be outdated the day I post the podcast. If you think you're going to become a Michigan constitutional scholar because of my podcast, you're sadly mistaken. You'd do better with a Ouija board and a magic eight ball. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. If you need Michigan legal advice, you would be well served to contact the State Bar of Michigan and ask for their lawyer referral service program for a referral to an attorney who specializes in your legal matter.
This next case, titled Dwight Love versus Wayne County, is another federal court case interpreting Michigan constitutional law. But what I like about this case is it touches on two previous cases that we talked about in the last podcast, that specifically being the Bloss case and the Atkins case. Here's what's going on. In that previous case, Bloss, we were talking about a person who was denied bail post-conviction, or said another way, the defendant was found guilty in his criminal case but wanted to be afforded bail while awaiting his appeal to play itself out. With Atkins in our last case, he wanted his bail provided to him before he even had his trial. And there is real value to being a pre-trial defendant versus a post-conviction defendant. At least while you're a pre-trial defendant, you have the right to be presumed innocent. And along with that, there are certain privileges which come with it. My goodness, we even have that verbiage in the United States Constitution stating just that. But let me get into that procedural fact pattern and I'll explain what's going on here. So, Defendant Love was convicted in 1982 of felony murder, assault with intent to murder, and felony firearm. He was sentenced to 4 terms of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. However, over the next 13 years, Defendant Love filed numerous motions trying to get the convictions overturned. Finally, in 1994, he succeeded. He motioned to the court and was granted a new trial after it was found that there were constitutional violations which had occurred during his original 1982 trial. Among them, things such as ineffective assistance of counsel, inconsistent statements of an eyewitness to be examined, and failure of the prosecutor to present all exculpatory evidence to the defendant before and during trial. At the same time that the trial judge granted Defendant Love a new trial, the judge also granted Mr. Love a bond opportunity, which he took advantage of and bonded himself out of jail while awaiting his new court date. The Michigan Court of Appeals affirmed the new trial granted by the lower court trial judge, but they overturned the decision to grant Defendant Love a bond and simply stated,
"It is ordered that the defendant is to remain incarcerated pending resolution of this appeal. Any order of the lower court granting pretrial release of defendant are hereby vacated."
And that's all the Michigan Court of Appeals said about it. What's interesting is that the county prosecutor did not file a motion to revoke Defendant Love's bond when this new trial decision was being appealed up to the Michigan Court of Appeals. This was sort of an add-on decision by the Court of Appeals that they took on themselves. It wasn't necessarily being asked of them. The next day after this decision is made, Defendant Love appeals the Michigan Court of Appeals decision up to the Michigan Supreme Court. The defendant's argument was that the Michigan Court of Appeals acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner, which was in violation of the Michigan Constitution. But the Michigan Supreme Court did not see it that way, and they upheld the denial of bond to Defendant Love. All right, so a year goes by, and Defendant Love still hasn't had his new trial, but remember, he's sitting in Wayne County Jail. At this point, he now files a habeas corpus request with the federal district court judge. And Defendant Love hangs his hat on our previous case of Atkins versus the people of Michigan. As you'll recall, that case held that the Michigan Court of Appeals canceling Defendant Atkins' pretrial bond without giving any reasoning was a violation of Defendant Atkins' right to due process of law. But here in this case, the county prosecutor's office says to the judge, whoa, hold the phone. The difference between Defendant Atkins and his trial compared with this case and Defendant Love is that Defendant Atkins was a pre-trial defendant who is awaiting trial to determine guilt or innocence. Whereas here, with Defendant Love, he's already been found guilty of murder. As a matter of fact, he served 13 years prison time for that murder. So the fact that Love has been found guilty and is asking for bail, he should be thought of more like Defendant Bloss, who is requesting a post-conviction bail opportunity. At least goes the thought process of the county prosecutor. So this sets up the real quandary that the federal district court judge had to deal with, and that is, how do we treat Defendant Love? He's been found guilty. He's asking for a post-conviction bail, is he not? But the state trial court judge, he's giving Defendant Love a new trial. So what is Defendant Love's status in the eyes of the law? Is he a pre-trial defendant despite being convicted 13 years ago? Or is he a post-conviction defendant despite being granted a new trial? The reasoning that this is an important differentiation to make is because the rights and privileges that you get are different whether you're pre-trial or post-trial. And we've talked about this, but I really want to drive it home. When you're a pre-trial defendant, you get the presumption of bail being given to you, and you're given that right by the Michigan Constitution. On the other hand, if you're a post-conviction defendant requesting bail, the burden is on the defendant to show by clear and convincing evidence that he is not a danger to others and must show, again, by clear and convincing evidence, that there are substantial issues as to why the defendant should be given bond. So before a conviction, bail reasoning is in favor of the defendant. After a conviction, all right, you've gone to trial, the judge or the jury has found you guilty of the crime to which has been levied against you. After that conviction has been decided, bail reasoning against the defendant, all right, so that there's a much, much bigger hurdle, a mountain to climb, if you will, for the defendant to get bail after the defendant's been found guilty on whatever charges they're being charged with. Now, I get that this is a very simplified way of thinking about it, but it's not inaccurate. And I'm doing my best here to make this approachable to listeners to really understand in a nutshell how this is working. The judge ruled that Defendant Love is indeed a pre-trial defendant. All right. Pre-trial defendant is how our federal judge here found Mr. Love. Let's talk about why. First of all, Defendant Love, he's being housed within the Wayne County Jail, not a Michigan Department of Corrections prison. And where you call home, right, jail versus prison, depends on how you're looked at by the criminal justice system. Likewise, the trial judge undid the order of conviction, because remember, Defendant Love's conviction, it was overturned. And this also adds to why the judge then ultimately considered Defendant Love to be a pre-trial defendant. Thirdly, there are a smattering of cases out there which are very close to this sort of fact pattern, and in those cases, it was determined that the defendant should be viewed as a pre-trial defendant. So then here in this case, this particular federal judge ruled that he was going to treat the bail matter as related to Defendant Love as being a pre-trial defendant and should receive the privileges which come from having that status. All right. So having determined that Defendant Love was indeed a pre-trial defendant, the judge then rules that Bloss is not the applicable case to have merit over this situation at hand, because Bloss was a post-conviction defendant and was denied bail due to the defendant's history of repeatedly violating the state's obscenity laws. So now the judge has to decide whether Defendant Love's case was similar to the Atkins case. And the judge rules it is similar enough to follow that path. Because the judge views Defendant Love as a pre-trial defendant, the judge zeroes in on the lack of reasoning given when the Michigan Court of Appeals canceled Defendant Love's bond opportunity, which you'll remember mirrors the same path that Mr. Atkins had walked down. This judge held that Defendant Love had a protected liberty interest in remaining free on bond pending the prosecution's appeal of the new trial. Remember, the prosecutor was still out tilting at windmills regarding whether the new trial should be granted to the defendant. So this judge here said that he found the Court of Appeals cancellation of bond without any explanation. Well, that was an arbitrary denial of Defendant Love's protected liberty interest, and that violates his due process rights. Now, a quick how does it all end synopsis, you know, the now you'll hear the rest of the story. After the county prosecutor exhausted all possible appeal avenues available to him, the Wayne County trial court judge, who initially granted Defendant Love the new trial, would ultimately go on to dismiss all charges against Defendant Love. Although the state of Michigan attempted to retry Mr. Love, the trial court dismissed the charges against him in 2001. So, you still wonder whether judges have a ton of power? Still wonder if you should be learning about the candidates running for judges in your local elections? Let that one sink in. I have an interesting case here, which tackles our Article 1, Sections 15 and Article 1, Section 16 bail consideration, and it is People v. Dixon, a Michigan Supreme Court case from 1974. The fact pattern all revolves around Mr. Dixon driving with a suspended driver's license. Two state police troopers stopped Mr. Dixon at 3 a.m., and this 3 a.m. time is important to the case. Mr. Dixon was stopped because his muffler was faulty, thus making excessive noise. When Defendant Dixon produced his driver's license, one of the officers noticed a second driver's license in Dixon's wallet. The trooper called into dispatch and was advised that Defendant Dixon's driver's license was indeed suspended. Defendant Dixon was subsequently arrested for operating a motor vehicle with a suspended license. A contemporaneous frisk revealed no weapon on Mr. Dixon's person, and Dixon was transported to the local county jail. Upon arrival at the jail, Defendant Dixon was ordered into a small room, and there he was directed by an officer to remove the sweater that he was wearing. An investigation of the sweater's pocket revealed several packets of heroin. Defendant Dixon was then arrested for unlawful possession of a narcotic drug, and after a total strip and cavity search of Mr. Dixon, more heroin was found within his person. Okay, now here's where the rub lies, and no pun intended because of the cavity search. There was a law which provides for when a magistrate is not available, a local municipality can allow an individual to bail themselves out immediately after being charged with the specific misdemeanor if the defendant can pay up to $100, and it certainly could be less. Now, this particular judicial jurisdiction, they had established that anyone arrested for driving without a license, much like, well, exactly like Mr. Dixon was facing, driving without a license, in that instance, that person would only be required to pay a $35 bail and would be issued a court date and time to return for the actual misdemeanor charge that is driving while license suspended. So you have a law which allows for a person to post up to $100 bail for certain misdemeanors, and driving without a license was one of them, and that's again what Mr. Dixon is facing. And you can do that when a magistrate is unavailable to formally arraign you. But even more drilled down to brass tacks, you have this municipality taking advantage of the no magistrate arraignment by simply requiring $35 for what Mr. Dixon was brought in for. And remember, it's 3 a.m. when this is all taking place. So Mr. Dixon's driving on a suspended license is the epitome of what the law and the municipality had in mind regarding bail and release. So what do you do about this heroin that was found on and in Mr. Dixon once he's been brought into the county jail? Our Michigan Court of Appeals says you have to suppress the drugs found on Mr. Dixon as having violated his bail protections in violation of Article 1, Sections 15 and 16. Did the sound of a giant needle ripping across a record just play in your head? You're probably thinking, wait. How do the drugs get suppressed because his right to bail was violated? All right, stick with me, kids. I'm going to do my best to connect the dots. First, let's discuss something we've talked about in previous podcasts, but becomes applicable here. The notion of a search incident to an arrest versus an inventory search of a person incident to incarceration. Police have the legal authority to search your person for weapons to ensure you do not have something dangerous which could harm the police officer. And the police were completely in the right to do a pat-down on Mr. Dixon before they put him into their police cruiser to drive him to the county jail. That is considered to be a search incident to an arrest. He was placed under arrest for driving with a suspended driver's license. He was searched to find any sort of knife, gun, blackjack, club, you get the idea. But no weapon was found on Mr. Dixon, so they placed him in the cop car and took him off to jail. Because it was in the very early hours of the morning, no magistrate was on duty to formally charge Mr. Dixon and offer him a bail option. For that reason, the local county jail took advantage of the law, which said if a magistrate is unavailable, you can make a defendant post up to $100 and allow the defendant to leave, provided it was for this type of minor law violation. And apparently, driving on a suspended license occurred so frequently in St. Clair County that the county decided a person arrested for driving without a license and arrested at 3 a.m. specifically merely needed to pay the $35 and the defendant would be given a date and time to come back and be formally charged for that crime. But in our case here, that process didn't play out like that. Mr. Dixon was never told he could bail himself out by paying $35. Instead, they searched Mr. Dixon's sweater where they found heroin in his pocket. This led to a greater internal search of Mr. Dixon, and they found even more heroin. At that time, his arrest went from being a misdemeanor driving without a license crime to now a felony drug possession. But our Michigan Supreme Court said Mr. Dixon should never have had his sweater pocket searched at the county jail. If the sweater would never have been searched, the drugs in the pocket would never have been found, which means a cavity search would never have been conducted, resulting in even more packets of heroin to be discovered. Do you see the line of thinking that the Michigan Supreme Court justices are walking us through here? That sort of search, the search of his sweater pocket, to be exact, well, our state Supreme Court points out this was only allowed if he was going to be incarcerated in the county jail at that time. But his misdemeanor charge of driving while license suspended, well, that was a statutory right to post $35 bail, and it was a law which would have allowed him to leave pursuant to our Michigan Constitution's right to bail under Articles 15 and 16. The court concluded that Mr. Dixon had already been searched for weapons before he was put into the police car. The station house procedures were not intended, nor could they be justified as a further search for either weapons on Mr. Dixon's person or to discover any fruits of a crime. And let's be honest, finding heroin would be what they call it, the fruit of a crime. That crime being drug possession. What the police did, our Michigan Supremes held, was to perform an inventory search incident to incarceration. And because incarceration is not part of the crime, quote unquote, driving with a suspended license, then ultimately that search of Mr. Dixon and his sweater was illegal. Mr. Dixon was provided the legal right for bail, but was never offered that opportunity to post said bail. And that was a violation of Article 1, Sections 15 and 16 of our Michigan Constitution. Here's an interesting case. People v. Edmund, a 1978 case from the Michigan Court of Appeals. In this case, a bail decision made by a trial court judge is being challenged by both the defendant and the prosecutor. The defendant appeals the bail decision because he believed the bail amount was too high. The prosecutor appeals the decision because she felt the bail was too low. So here's what's going on in this case. Defendant Edmund was sitting in an Ingham County jail awaiting trial for one count of conspiracy to deliver heroin and 13 counts of delivery of heroin or possession with intent to deliver heroin. The circuit court judge placed bail at $75,000 for the conspiracy charge and $10,000 on each of the 13 intent to deliver charge allowed as a surety bond. The judge went through the assorted requirements as to why he was issuing a bond for the defendant, but what he didn't do was explain why he picked the dollar amounts he chose for each of the 14 charges that the defendant was facing at trial. On the other hand, the prosecutor went in a different direction and she argued to the Court of Appeals that it matters less why the judge gave the number that he selected when in reality, the prosecutor argued, it's that the amount that the judge did pick was way too low for this defendant. See, a few years back, the defendant solicited a person to kill a possible witness who is slated to testify against the defendant's brother. And if the potential witness was killed off, well, then the defendant's brother would likely be found innocent. But as our case at hand doesn't tell us why, defendant Edmund was never charged on this allegation of hiring the hitman to kill off the witness in his brother's criminal case. So the first thing the Michigan Court of Appeals does is to dismiss the appeal brought forward by the prosecutor who alleged that the bond should have been much higher. The Court of Appeals says that because the defendant was never tried for the alleged hiring of a hitman, it is irrelevant to factor that into a bail amount decision. And that makes sense, doesn't it? The defendant shouldn't be subject to a higher bond based purely on an allegation. He was never charged with that crime, and if a prosecutor isn't going to bring a case against the defendant, that would be completely unfair to use it as a factor in how much to set bail at for a defendant. The last thing we should want is for someone's bail to be set on pure rumor and conjecture. So the prosecutor's appeal loses. But what about the defendant's appeal that the bail was too high? Well, The Michigan Court of Appeal judges say that they can't make that decision. It's not that they wouldn't be willing to make that decision, but the real problem is the trial court never gave any reasons or factors to explain how he got to the number that he chose. There are 9 factors which a judge must meet on the record to reference when and how they're going to determine what bail should be set at. And the defendant's trial court judge didn't do that. So the Court of Appeals judges remanded the case back to the trial court judge to put on the record what factors were most relevant to him in choosing the dollar amount that he set. For that reason, the defendant didn't per se lose his appeal, but he didn't win either. What likely happened in this case is the judge went through each of the 9 factors and explained which ones had the greatest weight to him, and based on his reasoning, that's how and why he came up with the dollar amount that he did. And if the defendant again appeals that dollar amount, so long as the Court of Appeal judges believe that the trial court judge acted reasonably, the Court of Appeals would likely uphold the trial judge's decision. But the takeaway from this case is a bit of a Goldilocks approach. The defendant thought that the bail was too high, the prosecutor thought it was too low, and the Court of Appeal judges likely believed it to be just right. Here's a fascinating case, which impacted a defendant while he was out on bond, but the citizens of Michigan passed an amendment which arguably revoked his bail. Wait, what? Okay. So let's talk about this. It's the Michigan Supreme Court case of People versus Mark Gorbein, and it's from 1979. Now, I need you to pay attention to these dates because they are very relevant to the case at hand. On November 7th, 1978, a constitutional amendment was voted on and passed by the citizens of the state of Michigan. This newly passed amendment changed up our Article 1, Section 15 provision for a right to bail. Among other things, it would allow a judge to deny bail if someone is out on probation for a violent felony but commits a new violent felony. And that's exactly what happened to Defendant Gorbein. He was on probation for a prior conviction of a third-degree criminal sexual conduct charge and was charged with a new criminal offense, specifically first and second-degree criminal sexual conduct. Now, he was charged with the new crime on December 10th, 1978, but this new constitutional provision, it didn't actually become effective until December 23rd. So one more time, let's make this very easy to understand. The citizens of Michigan voted in favor of certain reasons to deny bail opportunities for those charged with crimes, and they voted in favor of doing that on November 7th. On December 10th, so we're looking at what, like 34 days later, our defendant here, he's charged with a crime under the circumstance whereby bond could be denied. And on December 23rd, it's now in effect. This new constitutional provision becomes effective on December 23rd. The prosecutor asks the judge on December 11th, really, to have our defendant's bond revoked because he meets this situation where he's on probation for a violent crime and has been charged with a new violent crime, again, while on probation for a violent crime. This literal fact pattern meets the circumstances of the new constitutional provision. To be clear, the prosecutor believed once the people voted in favor of the constitutional amendment, the intent of the people had been made known and should be followed. But our Michigan Supreme Court rejects the prosecutor's request to have the defendant's bond revoked. Why? Because on the day Defendant Gorbein was charged with a new violent felony charge while he was out on probation for a previous violent felony, the constitutional provision wasn't yet effective. Sure, the Michigan Supreme Court concedes it had been voted on and supported by the voters in Michigan on November 7th. But it wasn't actually considered constitutional law on December 10th, which was the day that the defendant was charged. They note that as a general rule, constitutional amendments operate prospectively and not retroactively. One more time, they operate prospectively out into the future, future things that happen. They do not operate retroactively, meaning we don't look backwards and try to catch people into a net of things that are now illegal but weren't illegal at the time. So it operates prospectively, not retroactively. This is particularly true where the constitutional amendment would have a substantive right. Our Supreme Court noted, defendant Gorbine was already free on bond at the time the amendment became effective. It was not even alleged that the defendant's situation had changed at all. Only the criteria for release of bond had changed. So maybe said another way, at the time the defendant was released on bond, he had a constitutional right to this particular bail option, provided that the conditions of bail were met. The defendant met those conditions and was provided bail. The new criteria for an opportunity to bail, well, that wasn't at play because Mr. Gorbine had done nothing to trigger this bond reversal review. He did nothing to cause a change. It was the Constitution that changed, not him. And that, our highest court in the state held, was no fault of the defendant. He should be allowed to live under the old law as it applied to him on the day the decision for bail was granted. And that's it, my friends. That is what I think you need to know about bail from a 30,000-foot aspect on our Michigan Constitution.
The Michigan Constitution podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not offer legal advice or create an attorney-client relationship. This podcast is hosted by Tony Snyder. For more information, visit TonySnyder.com, send an email to podcast@TonySnyder.com, or follow Tony on Twitter @TonySnyder. Catch new episodes on the 1st and 15th of each month. Thanks for listening.